Chapter 15.
This has to be about more than getting tough on chaos and disorder. I need to be tough on the causes of chaos and disorder: greed, corruption, and ambition.
Jason Solo, Joint GA Chief of State, speaking at a lunch for the heads of Coruscant Industry. Bevin Vassar Farm, Mandalore. Myrta put her finger to her lips, and the four of them stacked around the door as if getting ready to storm Fett's stronghold.
"I'll check," she said to Orade.
Bevin winked at her. Medrit just kept glancing at his chrono as if he didn't have time for all this.
"You can hide behind me if you like."
Orade licked his lips nervously.
"Sharika, when Fett says he'll break my legs, he's just looking for an excuse."
"He's a sick man, Guess. And if you tell anyone, I'll be the one doing the breaking."
Guess Orade would have faced a cannoned-up Chiss fleet armed only with a sharp stick and laughed about his chances of survival. But he was scared stiff of her grandfather. Myrta wondered if she was doomed to have all her romances doused liberally with freezing water, because everyone now knew she was a Fett. She leaned on the barn door. The building had been a drying shed, and two indignant faces turned to her.
"What are you doing to him?" she demanded. "Has he had a relapse or something?"
Fett was breathing hard, as if he was in a lot of pain, hands clenched against his chest, face white and waxy. A woman she'd never seen before stood over him, holding a large-bore needle-tipped syringe up to the light and checking the reservoir. Another man in a ragbag of assorted armor was standing with his back to the door. He didn't turn around.
"Jang kept his promise," Fett said, breathless. "Or he's having the last laugh and poisoning me. We'll see."
"There's a slower and less painful way of getting this where it needs to go," said the woman, flicking the syringe with her finger to clear air bubbles. "But there's no point messing around, given the state you're in, Mandalore. Direct into your bone marrow. Two shots to go."
"Just do it."
He took his hands off his chest and parted his shirt. Myrta was surprised how bony he was. He looked such a fit, strong man in full armor. She never wanted anyone else to see him like this.
"Is this the best Mandalore can offer me? A veterinarian who spends her working day with her arm up a—"
"Believe me, I prefer treating nerfs. Keep still, or I'll miss and puncture a lung, or worse."
"How long is this going to take?"
"Mandalore, do you know what the alternative site to the sternum is for this treatment?"
"Amaze me."
"The pelvic bones."
Fett's expression was predictably blank, and he didn't say another word. He looked away, and anyone else would have thought it was casual annoyance at having his schedule interrupted. But Myrta knew him well enough by now to see he was in excruciating pain. She took the risk of stepping forward and folding her hand around his. He took it, too. She thought he'd break every bone in her fingers when the vet lined up the needle, so big that Myrta could see the hole in the tip, and pressed it hard into his breastbone, as if she were preparing a nuna for roasting. There was an awful squelch. Orade swallowed loudly.
"If you're going to faint or throw up, son, go do it outside," the vet said irritably.
"Failing that, find some analgesics.
Where do you keep them?"
"Forget it," Fett said. "I need to know if you're doing me any damage."
It's okay, Babuir,
Myrta whispered.
You'll be okay.
If the Sarlacc didn't finish me off, she won't either.
The vet, all smiling menace, inserted the syringe in a glass vial to refill.
Last one. Shut your eyes and think of Mandalore.
Myrta glanced over her shoulder at the man in the multicolored armor. He slipped off his helmet.
Just making sure he doesn't die before he does something useful for Mandayayim, said the man. If it works, and it should, then he'll start to show signs of recovery in a few days.
He looked a lot like Fett and Jang, and the resemblance was unsettling. The Kifar part of her, the one that cared about bloodlines, told her this was her kin. Clones got around a bit during the war. She probably had a lot more genetic relatives than she'd first thought. Fett crushed Myrta's fingers again and didn't make a sound. The vet straightened up and opened a bottle of pungent-smelling liquid to clean her hands.
Normally, I swat my patients across the rump and let them get on with grazing. But seeing as it's you, I'll skip that and suggest you take it easy for a day or so. Expect a big bruise.
Fett gave her a silent nod of acknowledgement as she left and fastened his undershirt. Then he looked up at Myrta.
Say hello to your Uncle Venku.
He indicated the man in the motley armor, who still hadn't acknowledged her.
Alias Kadika.
It was all making sense now. Kadika had to be the son of a clone trooper. There must have been a lot of them out there, and she wondered how many of them had any social graces or senses of humor, or if they all took after Babuir.
"Just doing my bit for Mandalorian unity," Venku said, slipping his helmet back on as if her close inspection was making him uncomfortable. "Wouldn't do for the Mandalore to snuff it just when we're on the rise again."
He leaned over Fett and put two fingers against the pulse in his neck. Myrta expected her grandfather to flatten him for daring to lay hands on him, but he simply looked at the assorted plates of Beskar Gam with idle curiosity and tolerated the examination.
"Your heart rate's up," Venku said. "Get some rest."
"Field medic."
"Yeah, they say I have a healing touch."
Myrta found that hard to believe. Venku straightened up.
"Any problems, tell the folks at Seacarton's Tapcaf in town. They'll know how to contact me."
Venku made for the door. As he brushed past her, he stopped and tapped his finger against the heart of fire dangling from her neck. He obviously never worried about getting a punch in the face.
"Interesting," he said.
He was a chancer, a man who could obtain things, and obviously information as well. It was worth a try.
"It's a heart of fire," she said. "It belonged to my grandmother. I need a full-blooded Kifar to help me read the memories imprinted in it."
He paused for a few moments.
"Mandoade come from all kinds of places. If I find anyone who can read the stone, I'll let you know."
Then he was gone. Orade nudged Bevin.
"Go on," Orade said. "Tell him. It'll make him happy." "Okay, happier. Happy people heal faster."
Fett put his armor plates back on.
"What's going to make me happy?"
Bevin had the beatific smile of a man who'd finished laying up stores for the winter and just enjoyed a big meal.
"Yomaget's got something to show you."
Fett grunted. He was the least expressive man Myrton knew, but he seemed vaguely disappointed.
He's got the Besu leak spaceworthy, has he?
Bang goes the surprise.
It's the thought that counts.
He stood up and was instantly transformed from her sick Babu ear into Boba Fett, ruthless and relentless. But he didn't stride out the door right away. She took a guess that he was feeling the effects of the treatment and wasn't going to admit it, not even in front of people who knew exactly what was wrong.
Where is it?
She gestured to the ceiling and offered him her arm. Myrta was still looking for a reason not to hate Fett, and she was ready to look pretty deeply. She decided she could start by loving him for his sheer guts. Nothing fazed him, nothing stopped him, and nothing made him feel sorry for himself. They stood outside the barn and waited in silence. It looked like a tiny hut set against Slave One, laid up in her horizontal mode nearby. A low rumble interrupted the rural peace. Fett looked up as a dull black wedge shot across the sky and vanished behind a forested hill. Myrta lost it, but then it circled back again, came to a dead halt in mid-air about 200 meters above them, and descended smoothly on burners. It landed on its blunt tail section, and then extended struts to tilt through 90 degrees and come to rest horizontally like a conventional starfighter. The canopy lifted, and Yomagett climbed out, slid onto the ground, and kissed the matte fuselage.
"Sharika,"
he said to the ship, running a tender hand over the skin.
"I think I'm in love."
"Nice," said Fett.
"Puts the Ulik in Besu leak."
"Yeah, I can see it's a beast. What's different?"
"We applied the micronized Beskar skin, Mandalore. She's a toughened Shabu ear now. Care to show her to the Verpine?"
"It'd get their attention."
"If they share their ultramesh technology with us, we might be able to lighten the airframe and improve her top end in atmosphere. If we skin her completely in solid Beskar, she's going to be invulnerable but heavy."
"We'll keep the heavy ones. Maybe the Verpine can come up with a better fuel solution."
"Well, if you're not going to take her for a spin, I will,"
said Medrit. He scrambled up onto the wing and eased himself into the cockpit, looking as if he would fill it.
"Shob, a Mondo Verpine assault fighter. That'll cause some sleepless nights on Coruscant."
"If we can mine and process the ore fast enough."
Yomagett looked hopeful.
"We could ask those helpful insectoid chaps to lend us an orbital facility or two."
"I'll go see them," Fett said. "Got to think long-term on this. No point handing over too much to Roche early in the game."
Medrit spent the next hour taking the prototype Besulik through its paces over the Keldabe countryside, while the rest of them watched. Yomagett captured the aerobatics on his holorecorder, looking satisfied.
"Might slip this hologram out to a few contacts," he said. "We're not a modest people, are we?"
"Remind them that most of our adult population can fly a fighter, too," Fett said. "For starters."
He went back inside the barn. He didn't manage a smile, but Bevin turned to Myrta and cocked his head.
"Believe it or not, that's a happy man."
Maybe he was a better judge of mood than she was. She was relieved just to hear Fett use the phrase long-term. Times were changing. The rest of the galaxy might have been tearing itself apart, but the Mandalore sector, which now informally controlled Roche, if a protectorate agreement counted, was a haven of optimism after a decade or more of grim existence. That night, Myrta found the Oyubat Tapcalf packed with new faces, and the singing was raucous. If Jason Solo, her mother's murderer, had been roasting slowly over the Oyubat's open fire instead of the side of Nerf, Myrta might even have joined in. Senate Building, Coruscant. Jason's official airspeeder brought him up to the main Senate entrance. He could have entered the building by any number of more private platforms, but he had no intention of sneaking in via the back doors. Being seen counted for a lot, and he still had his heroic image to protect. A line of citizens waited outside the doors that admitted members of the public to the viewing galleries. Some just wanted to watch the day's business, but there was a small group who were clearly protesters. It wasn't just the Free Omis banner that three of them were carrying among them. There was a taste of anger in the force, vivid despite the permanent background of fear and uncertainty. "Drop me here," Jason said. "I'll walk."
"They'll harass you, sir," said the grand chauffeur. "I ought to take you straight up to your floor."
"They've got a right to see who's governing them." It wasn't as if they could cause him any harm. "I find that talking to people generally clears up misunderstandings." Jason had expected at least one mass protest or a riot broken up by water cannon and dispersal gas. GAG intelligence showed that Corellian agents still operating on Coruscant were doing their best to make that happen. But the general willingness of the population to accept the change of regime surprised him. The stock exchange had suspended trading for a few hours, and some shares had bounced around, but the traffic still flowed. The stores were full of food, HoloNet programming was uninterrupted, and everyone was getting paid. Unless you were Cal Omis or a civil liberties lawyer, the military junta was temporary and benign. There was a war on, after all. It was to be expected. "I ought to write a study on this." "How to take over the state? Smile, look reluctant, and keep the traffic flowing." And it was just Coruscant. The rest of the GA worlds went on running their planetary business as they saw fit, unmolested, and that meant there was no need to stretch the fleet and the defense forces by deploying them to keep order on thousands of other worlds, their own in many cases. All Jason and Neothel had to worry about was Coruscant, because the political and strategic reality was that Coruscant was the GA, was Coruscant. "The rest of the Alliance is detail. I have its heart and mind." "Good morning," Jason said. The group of protesters stared at him with a collective, slowly dawning, "Oh, it's really him," expression. Even a face that had been on HNE as regularly as his took some recognizing out of context. He extended his hand to them, and one man actually shook it. Most species responded well to placatory courtesy. "I just wanted to reassure you that Master Omis will get a scrupulously fair hearing. We've let him go home, too."
When folks were worked up for yelling and seemed to want to be dragged away by CSF heavyweights, they were totally upended by having the object of their fury listen to them. Jason's patient smile met disoriented surprise. A couple of CSF officers began wandering across, probably expecting trouble, but Jason dissuaded them with a little force influence, and they stopped a few meters away to observe. More important, though, was the HNE news droid trundling around the Senate Plaza. There was always at least one on duty here, just hanging around to get stock shots, but now it had an actual story. Jason watched it approach in his peripheral vision.
"Doesn't matter how you dress it up,"
said the young woman, holding one end of the Free Omas banner.
"The GA is being run now by the Supreme Commander and the head of the secret police, and nobody voted for you."
Jason managed an expression of slightly wounded innocence.
"You're right. I didn't run for office, which is why I won't remain Joint Chief of State any longer than I have to. Would you like to see something? Inside the building?"
The woman looked at him suspiciously.
"There's always a catch."
The news droid was right behind them now. Sometimes the Force placed things in his grasp. Suddenly he realized that everything was being handed to him, and all he had to do was react, just as Lumia had told him, and not analyze everything.
"Your choice," Jason said. "I just want to show you the Chief of State's office. Anyone else want to come along?"
The security guards weren't happy, but what Jason wanted, Jason got. He led a straggling group of protesters, day visitors, and the HNE droid through the glittering lobby and up in the turbo lift to the floor of offices where the public was almost never allowed, the seat of galactic government itself. A few civil servants in the corridor did a double-take, but carried on about their business. Neothel must have seen him come in on the security holocams, because she was wandering around the lobby clutching a couple of data pads. Jason acknowledged her with a smile and walked up to the carved double doors of the Chief of State's suite of offices. The doors were sealed, taped shut. The bright yellow tape with the CSF logo and the legend "Do Not Tamper" was purely cosmetic, but it made the point far better than the impregnable but invisible electronic lock.
"That's Chief Omas's office," Jason said, over the head of the HNE droid.
He stood back casually to let it get a better shot of him explaining earnestly to this random sample of the electorate.
"It's for the elected head of state. It stays sealed until someone is elected to fill it. Neither I nor Admiral Neothel has moved in. That matters very much to us."
The thing about Mon Cals was that you could never tell if they were rolling their eyes or just taking notice. Neothel was probably rolling hers, though. Jason could feel her amusement at his expense. The little crowd muttered and oohed and aahed. It was a perfect media moment. The protesters seemed at a loss for words, but Jason was anxious that they not look humiliated.
"I hope we've reassured you." "You're up to your neck in this too, Admiral. And I'm glad you feel you can raise this with us, because there's no point fighting a war if we can't behave as a democracy, even when things get difficult."
The jumpy security guards who'd decided to follow him showed the party out. Everyone went away either happy or at least diffused. Jason felt Neothel's gaze boring a hole in him.
"Last time I saw anything that slick and oily," she said, "was when Ocean leaked a whole lube reservoir over the aft weapons flat."
"Ah, but you were absolutely right to seal that office. Neither of us should have it."
"I believe in sharing everything."
"As do I," Jason said.
"So let's try to address the media jointly, shall we? No point looking like a publicity addict, Jason. Citizens might misunderstand your motives."
"I'm here to serve the galaxy," Jason replied, and meant every word. "Never underestimate the power of being pleasant."
"That's fine on Coruscant, but your charm doesn't travel well."
Neothel beckoned him to follow.
I have Senator Gasil in my office. And the senator for Mercana, Nav Ekat. We've hit a small snag in our new policy.
Ekat didn't look like a woman who'd had a restful night. She didn't wait for Jason to sit down before she launched into a tirade that had obviously been gathering steam long before he and Neafel walked in.
I understand you're concentrating forces in the Corellian and Bothan sectors, she said, stabbing her finger at the holochart in the center of the meeting table. Where does that leave us?
Explain your concerns, said Jason.
The new treaty between Roche and Mandalore.
And you feel threatened by this?
Given the state of our relations with Roche, yes. Are you aware that we've been having a disagreement about export markets?
Gasil leaned forward. Put another way, the Verpine are accusing Mercana of reverse-engineering some of their most lucrative weapons command systems, breaching their patents, and selling cheap knockoffs to undermine their markets.
Put another way, Verpine don't like healthy competition, said Ekat. Now they've signed a deal with Mandalore for mutual aid and technical collaboration. It's the Bugs and Thugs show.
Jason watched Neafel shift ever so slightly in her seat and felt her annoyance. Anyone who dismissed Verpine as bugs probably also dismissed Mon Cals as fish. Are you expecting this alliance to threaten your security directly? Jason asked. Because if the Verpine were seriously annoyed, they have plenty of military hardware to make their point without calling in Kaldabe.
Verpine might make the stuff, she said, but they rarely use it in anger. The Mandalorians, on the other hand, treat warfare as a national sport.
But this is about Mandalorian iron.
Neafel was working up to telling Ekat that Mercana was on its own. She'd probably enjoy it after that bug comment, too.
The Verpine want to produce enhanced armaments and vessels under license.
No, they want Mandalorian protection, too.
Why? Jason couldn't see Mercana attacking Roche.
They're afraid the fighting on Kemstor I will spill into their backyard, and they're rich pickings that might prove too tempting for a system at war.
I'm missing the connection.
Mandalorian protection tends to be of the outreach kind, Colonel. It's a short step from turning out to repel the Kemi and making a disciplinary visit to us.
Neafel got up and walked around the table, looking at the holochart from various angles.
And are you breaching the Verpine patents?
We don't think so, said the senator. But the products are very similar.
You see, I'm not sure we should commit troops to trade disputes. This war is about the responsibility of member planets to commit military resources to common defense. That's one reason why the former chief of state is former, because he was ready to concede part of that principle.
As a member of the GA, we expect support when attacked.
Roche is a neutral world, Jason pointed out. If you were attacked, we'd have to assess the situation. But I feel this has to be referred to the Interplanetary Civil Courts first.
So you're saying we're on our own?
Jason would play the nice officer today. Neafel was doing a fine job of being the nasty one. I'm saying that you should try to resolve this dispute by other means, rather than escalate straight to saber-rattling. But, he thought about the talk of a new Mandalorian assault fighter. It was interesting enough on its own, but if it was a collaboration with the Verpine, the GA needed to get an idea of what it could do. He decided to disagree with Neafel. But perhaps the presence of a GA squadron and frigate might make Roche more willing to sit down and discuss the matter again. Neathel turned her head very slowly to stare at Jason. He knew the risk he was taking.
If we have spare resources, then we'll consider it, she said.
Roche warned us that it'll take direct action if we don't cease production of the disputed products.
Eckhart looked at all three of them pointedly in sequence, as if defying them to say the word no out loud. Then she stood and picked up her folio case.
So sooner rather than later, please, or you'll lose another Rimworld. And I don't mean resignation.
Gasil watched Eckhart stalk out, then shrugged.
So much for the Mandalorian threat making the little planets rush to our protective arms, Cha.
They did rush, Neathel said. And that's the problem. If we're seen deploying a Star Destroyer every time some member state has a local disagreement, we'll open the floodgates. Not that they're not starting to open already. Policy is to concentrate on breaking the big boys who won't play by GA rules, or we'll be putting out fires across the galaxy for decades to come.
Jason braced for impact.
And Colonel Solo, you will not commit fleet resources like that without discussing the matter with me.
I didn't commit anything. I just stated the obvious.
And I didn't agree to it either.
Wouldn't it be useful to have an excuse to wander out to the rim and take a look at those new Mandalorian fighters?
If they've built any yet.
I say commit a couple of flights if we can't spare a complete squadron. If we move one of the frigates out from Bothan space, that'll bring it within range of Mercana. At a stretch.
Are you sure you want to provoke Mandalore? Gasil asked. It's got that extra personal dimension now. And the last thing we need is Fett making this a vendetta against the rest of the GA. His neutrality has been a bonus, to be honest.
I'm well aware that Fett has neither gone away nor forgotten his daughter, Jason said. But he's far too smart to waste his troops to fight a personal feud. Mandalore was always a problem. Always had been, always would be. It wasn't big enough to be a galactic threat, but wasn't small enough to dismiss or remove.
Tough on chaos and the causes of chaos.
It was being the third element in a universe of pairs that made Mandalorians disruptive. The universe was binary, bipolar, ruled by the balance between opposites, whether that was dark and light, or action and reaction. It couldn't accommodate that extra pole and remain orderly. Mandalorians were an inherently destabilizing influence.
"Are you still with us, Jason?" Gasil asked. "You look distracted."
"Just wishing the Mandalorians would go away."
"Pay them to stay at home," said Neathel, gathering up her data pads to leave. "That's the permanent solution. As long as they have the occasional therapeutic fight to work off their aggression, they'll be happy. And that's just the females."
She headed for the door.
"I have fleet commanders to brief. Shame we can't approach Fett to see if he's changed his mind about staying out of the fighting."
"Isn't paying them not to fight tantamount to an insult to their honor?" Jason asked.
"I think you're getting them mixed up with some other warmongering savages. They'd see it as protection money. They're pragmatists."
"If only all wars had such simple economic solutions." Gasil smiled ruefully. Well, they've mostly got economic causes.
Not this one, Jason said. It's about order. About responsibility.
Neothel and Gasil both concealed their reactions at the same time and said nothing. He could tell they thought he was becoming eccentric, or perhaps that he hadn't quite got the hang of high-level politics. Either way, their reaction said that he wasn't playing the same game as them. And they were right. But it was all going too smoothly. No riots, no outcry except for some of the minority media and the usual suspects in the legal and liberties community. But apart from endless media analysis of Omis's time in office, almost as if he'd died, the vast majority of Coruscanti had treated it like a fall from grace instead of a military coup. Having a Jedi on board did seem to make the regime change appear much more wholesome in public opinion.
"I'd expected to be storming barricades this week," Jason said. "What did we do right?"
"We didn't suspend any normality," said Gasil, making interesting use of "we." "Every other politician remained in place. Just the people who administer it at the top level changed."
"Order. It's all about order. This is the microcosm of the entire galaxy. The dry run for how my rule will be in due course. Quiet normality for the majority."
But Jason was worried that it might prove to be the lull before the storm. He thought of Tenel Ka and Alana, and the impulse to visit them while he still could was overwhelming. Lumia said he had to listen to those voices, and not think sensible things like mundane beings did.
"I need 48 hours out of the office," he said, "to catch up on things. Can I trust you two not to oust me while I'm away?"
Neothel didn't seem amused.
"You'll return to find Boba Fett sitting in your office. But if you have to go, you must."
"I trust you implicitly," he said. He trusted her not to be stupid, at least.
Lumia could keep a watchful eye on the situation while he made the trip to Hapes.
Boba Fett. That was an axe still waiting to fall. And if it didn't keep him awake at night, he was certainly conscious that Fett's continued lack of bloody revenge was unsettling.
Jason put the Mandalorians on the list of things for which he'd find a solution when he was established as a Sith Lord. Vader had had the measure of them in his day. Jason would as well. That, too, was in his destiny. Luminous Gardens Spa, Drawl, Corellian System.
"So, still no new Prime Minister?" Mara asked.
"You're taking a big risk coming here," said Leia. "No, there's a triumvirate of the three main party leaders running Corellia until they find a new target. Sorry, I mean candidate. Two dead inside a few months tends to dampen the applicant's enthusiasm. Well, we score for efficiency. At least we can run the GA on, too."
"How very Sith."
Mara nearly choked. It wasn't funny at all. Did Leia know something?
"Mara, are you okay? I think my encounter with Lumia made me allergic to the word."
With a scarf around her hair, Mara was just another middle-aged female human enjoying the resort with a friend. The two walked around the colonnade of exclusive stores and beauty salons, and Mara still found it disconcerting that anyone could be leading a normal life when hers, and that of so many others, was caught up in the turmoil of war. Normality seemed somehow obscene.
I had to see you face to face. You don't want Jason to arrest you for setting foot on Coruscant, and you know he would. Where's Han?
He's gone on an errand with Lando. Where's Luke?
Seeing as it's just us girls talking, I smell a delicate problem.
There was no point tiptoeing around it. Mara had as much evidence as she needed, but this was Leia's son under discussion. Leia had already lost Anakin. Mara had to be absolutely, completely certain. 99% sure wasn't good enough.
Jason, she said, always is. I don't know how to say this to you.
Try blurting.
He's out of control. I mean badly out of control.
Uh-huh. I admit it's challenging to have to keep tabs on your only son by watching the news coverage of his latest power grab.
How's Han taking it?
Not well, to say the least. He veers between wanting to disown him again and talking about getting together to talk him around. You know, sometimes I think it's going to kill him.
Mara found that it wasn't certainty of Jason's guilt she was looking for. It was any excuse to say that it was all Lumia's doing, and that by removing her, Jason could be brought back to his old self. Whatever had happened to Jason over the years, and that 5-year sabbatical was still largely a blank sheet, there seemed nothing of that old self left to recover.
If this wasn't my nephew and Leia's son, would I still be trying to find a reason not to do something about him? No.
You're sure you're feeling okay, Mara?
Leia was one of the few people Mara had ever truly admired. She was pretty well the only person other than Luke who Mara knew would never fall apart, however bad things got. But she still couldn't bring herself to sit Leia down and give her the full catalogue of Jason's crimes. Yes, they were crimes. There was no other word for it.
I'm going to ask you something, Leia, and if you never want to speak to me again afterward, I'll understand.
This isn't going to end in a punchline, is it? You're serious.
You have no idea how serious.
Then stop dragging it out.
Okay, do you think Jason is susceptible enough to be controlled by Lumia? I should have put the list to her first. I should have told her about Nalani, and making Ben kill Gedjon, and his little chats with his Sith buddy, and the fact that he seems to think my son is expendable.
And apprentice? What kind of apprentice would Lumia be talking about? Mara faced the inevitable, and hated herself for refusing to see it earlier.
No,
Leia said at last.
He's stubborn, and he's his own man. She could make the difference between him doing something and hesitating, but she could never make him act totally against his will. I've had to come to terms with that, but he's still my boy, and I still love him.
It was the last thing Mara wanted to hear. She wanted to hear that Jason was a kid who went along with the others, who got into bad company but was a good boy at heart. She wanted a reason to go after evil Lumia and rescue deluded Jason, because that was easy, black and white, palatable. Wrong. If it hadn't been happening within her own family, she'd never have hesitated. For a moment, she wondered if she was set on this. This didn't have a name yet, not a word, but she knew what this was, because it was her own son at most risk.
My son or yours?
It could have been selfish maternal priority, just using the rest of Jason's actions to justify lashing out to save her child. She tried to imagine Ben dead, and how she'd feel then. She could have stopped Palpatine and didn't. History had taught her a lesson about hindsight, and it wouldn't give her a second chance. What was happening to Ben would happen to other people's sons, too.
Mara, I think you should have spent a few days in bed after the fight with Lumia, said Leia, and slipped her arm through hers. You're not yourself at all. Let's find a stupidly expensive restaurant and forget the fat content. Take it easy for a few hours, because I can't run on adrenaline and anxiety 24 hours a day like you seem to. Leia, I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to stop Jason. I have to. I'm going to have to kill your son, because that's the only way of stopping him now.
Okay, but my treat.
You're on.
Part of Mara was appalled that she could even think it, and part was telling her that this was what happened when she forgot that Force users' highs and lows weren't just family spats, but dynastic battles that could shake the whole galaxy. They didn't have the luxury of small stakes.
I like the fountain, Leia said. They do a dessert called the Fruit Mountain. Takes 2 hungry women to tackle one.
Sounds good.
It was surreal. They sat on opposite sides of the table. Blue-white Dia wood set with iridescent transparent tableware, and a pyramid of multicolored fruit held together by golden spun sugar and dusted with real citrus-flavored snow, was placed between them. There was a point at which Mara's eyes met Leia's as they attacked the dessert with a spoon each, and it would be a frozen moment of horror in Mara's mind forever. Leia smiled, the look in her eyes pure compassion, and Mara knew that she couldn't see the truth behind hers. She felt like dirt. She hated herself.
You need to know there's nothing else, absolutely nothing that you can do to save Jason.
Mara needed to confront him one last time. If anyone could stop him at the brink, the final one anyway, then it was her, because she'd crossed from the other direction. She didn't think it would work, but she owed it to Leia. And Han. She was planning to take Jason from them, and they'd already lost Anakin. There was only so much pain a family could take.